Morning, everybody. I'm super excited to welcome John Yankee from Tackle.io. John, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited to talk to you about the marketplace, where it has come from, where it is, and where it's going. But before we get going, would you please take maybe a minute or two to introduce yourself as well as the company?
Yeah, so I'm John. I'm CEO of Tackle. We started Tackle in 2016, and my co-founder, Dylan Woods, had the vision that the cloud providers would change the way that software was sold. And this marketplace thing represented the initiation point of that. And we started to experiment with that value proposition. We grew up really like in enterprise B2B emerging technology sales and pre-sales. Dylan and I were both SEs early in our career. And I think a lot of that SE mindset like still lives in us today. And, you know, so Dylan started to play around with what could it mean to start to make the marketplace movement come to life. And we landed on the value proposition of making it easier for ISVs to start to list and sell through these cloud marketplaces. And at that time, it was really AWS only, but we always thought this would be a multi-channel e-commerce value proposition. Like sellers would want to sell where their buyers want to buy, and no one cloud rules them all. So, and typically when a new service comes online, all the other clouds will follow suit. So that actually played out from 2016 to 2019 as Microsoft and Google both followed suit with what AWS was doing with Marketplace. And then, you know, the problems just continued to get more complicated as we've seen. You know, our very first customer was New Relic. And New Relic was like, hey, I've been monkeying around with this Marketplace thing for a while, and it's way harder than we want it to be. Can you help us? Like what you guys are doing really resonates. And we were able to help them go on to build a really material channel with AWS. And like from the success of our customers, we found new problems. And it was not just about like tapping into the clouds and the cloud budget and doing deals, but it was about the workflow of selling and how you make it easier as an ISV to sell more, sell faster, sell more efficiently by tapping into these cloud budgets and platforms and large programs that were happening in the enterprise. And so much has happened since then, and I live in Buffalo, New York. Our team is born and built remote. So 160 tacklers all around the US and Canada. And we just have a lot of fun helping all partner types now, just beyond ISVs, all partner types embrace, you know, going to market through the cloud providers.
That's amazing. So I want to dial back a little bit, go back to the moment of conception.
Yeah.
Talk to me, because I love talking to founders. I learned a lot. And everybody has a unique way of sort of coming up with the idea and then starting. So go back to the moment when you and your co-founder, you know, maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years that you're kind of going through this idea, noodling on a napkin. Walk us through that journey. Like, how did this form? How did this come about? And how did you start?
Yeah, it wasn't a one-time thing. So Dylan, Brian, and I, there's actually three of us. We all worked together at a software company called Greenplum. And Greenplum was a big data analytics company, kind of a pioneer back in parallel database universe. Before Snowflake existed, before like cloud services like Redshift existed, people did that inside of data centers. Greenplum was one of the ways they did that. And at that time, you know, I joined from EMC. EMC acquired Greenplum. Dylan and Brian were there. We all came together as a team, and we're just helping big enterprises solve these problems. And, you know, for me, it was my first time in a more entrepreneurial environment. Dylan and Brian were longtime startup guys, and we just kind of meshed, like had a lot of fun working together. So I do think so much of the origin story of a company starts with the team. Like, who do you want to work with? Who are you inspired to work with? What are their strengths and weaknesses? What are your strengths and weaknesses? And how do you blend together to actually be a team that can succeed? Because starting companies is hard. Building startups is hard. And you have to have like the right mix of mindset and experience around you. So I'd start with that first thing, team. And way back then, like 2010, we didn't know we were going to start a company together, but it just kind of naturally happened. And then Dylan is really our CTO, pioneer, visionary, can see around corners unlike many people. And he really was the one with the idea, but the idea started with this idea of provisioning software is really hard. And it still to this day is pretty hard. I talked to lots of software companies, and automating the provisioning process tends to fall pretty far down the engineering backlog. Product-led growth companies are born with that at the core of who they are, but a lot of companies, B2B software especially, don't start with that product-led mindset. So provisioning was a problem, and it was a unique problem. And we'd spent a lot of time in like container, the container world. So there was a lot of experience with provisioning. So we played around with provisioning, and that actually led us to Marketplace, because we thought Marketplace could help people provision software more easily. But what we discovered was all of the commerce problems that existed with Marketplace. So it really, I mean, you could go through those early days. There was a solid year of experimentation with the Marketplace in these formative periods to try to figure out what was the value prop that resonated with who we thought our economic buyer would be. Our economic buyer would be an ISV. And then how could we deliver value to them in a way that they would be willing to pay for? Like, you got to solve these fundamental problems of product. Are they willing to pay? And then can you make them successful? And I think, like, as a team, Dylan is a kind of engineer mind, visionary mind. I'm more of like a go-to-market, pre-sales, marketing mind. And our third co-founder, Brian's really a partnership mind. And the fact we were built on top of the clouds, his partnership BD experience proved invaluable for pioneering the way this works. So I start with team, then you get to product market fit, and how do you solve a problem that uniquely someone will pay for? And then how do you start to think about scale? And I mean, there's so much more to it, but that's a bit of those like formative moments of tackle.
So going back to 2016 timeframe, right, when you were starting, what was out there? Like, who were the other players? Was it sort of a completely blue ocean, or were there other players in different ways that you thought you could do a better job than what they're doing? Like, what was the market like?
Yeah, it was a blue ocean. I mean, like, people would say Tackle was a category creator at that time. The only way to embrace these cloud marketplaces was to build. And no one wants to build software to sell software. And we looked at companies like Shopify and companies like Stripe, and who had really changed the nature of the way commerce was happening. And we're like, why hasn't that happened in B2B software yet? And so at that time, it was very early. And I'd still say it's super early, as far as like when you look at the dollars, $1 trillion of B2B software sold, only maybe 50 billion of it's flowing through the marketplace. It's 5% adoption. That's growing 100% year over year. It's a lot. But so it was pretty blue ocean at the time. And I think we operated in that way for a few years. And it was a really common question. People would say, like, is this really a market? Like, is there a scalable business there? But we always looked at that, like, selling software is the most expensive part of every software company, and is yet really to be optimized even to this day. So, like, the combination of all that is just all these mega trends. You have the cloud trend, you have B2B software sales efficiency trend. At the time, like, we kind of were still pretty young when COVID hit, which was, I think, a pretty pivotal point in evolving the way B2B companies purchase things, kind of like rapidly accelerated this digital transformation of the B2B procurement process. So there's, I mean, just a lot of different factors.
But then going back to 2016, when you're starting, right, you saw this as a big idea, big opportunity. Therefore, the solution requirement is possibly also big. What was your MVP? Like, where did you start and why did you start there?
Yeah, we originally, our first version of our website had a multi-cloud commerce solution image on it, but we actually, because Microsoft and Google did not have the primitives to enable this to work yet. AWS was the only one that had the primitives. And we're like, we're going to downscope and focus on, can we help an ISV list and sell through AWS Marketplace? And that was our original MVP. And in reality, the API landscape that exists today didn't exist at all. Like, there was a lot of manual work, or really creative engineering work, we had to do around the problem in order to get that automation to work. And then we were able to work with the clouds to start to say, there's a better way to do this. API-driven architecture would make this easier for everybody. But downscoping down to that unique value prop. And when we got there, we're like, we think the future will be multi-channel, multi-cloud e-commerce, but like, let's just see, can we get to 50 customers with AWS? And we were able to go, like, there's kind of this, Jason Lemkin talks about this, like, 0 to 1, 1 to 10, 10 to 100 phenomenon. And we were like, okay, can we get to 0 to 1? We were able to get to 1. And then we're like, can we make that repeatable with AWS and the core value prop delivered as SaaS? We're able to do that 10 times. Then we're able to scale it to 50. And the amazing thing that happened in that zero to 50 journey was our customers really drove our requirements, because they're like, this doesn't work for finance. We can't track offers. We can't track metering records. How do we solve all these problems? Which really just started to like build the backlog of everything you needed to do post that MVP.
So let's come now. So if you took your solution today, how would you sort of break it, like put, you know, break it up and put together maybe different pieces that create that solution that you had in mind versus what you have today?
It's been, so there's really four pillars of Tackle, and there's a lot of smaller pieces under the covers, but we've built a data system that allows us to analyze your marketing and sales funnel to give you buyer intent for cloud, because like this is not only about helping people sell through the clouds, it's helping them map their demand gen and sales systems to the clouds. So we built this data system. That's one pillar of the product. There's a lot of different ways to use that: sales use cases, marketing use cases, corporate strategy use cases. The second pillar of the product centers around co-sell automation, because what every partner of the clouds want are leads. And the way you get leads are building a co-sell machine with them. And there's a lot under the covers of co-sell machine, but like you can look at that co-sell machine and say there's automation between it that connects your sellers and the cloud provider sellers together to deliver joint value to your joint customer. The third part is all the marketplace automation work that we've done. And that's continued to balloon in complexity as there's more business models than ever. There's more product types than ever. Like the marketplaces used to be this one kind of thing. Now they've broken down into like many different services that you have to solve for. So we see those being data, co-sell, marketplace. It's really part of the same workflow from your pipeline all the way to how you transact business. And then we manifest the experience around that inside of Tackle, which is a really easy way for people to get started. It's a web app experience, SaaS, and then also inside of Salesforce, which is where most of our at-scale sellers want to put these capabilities at the fingertips of their reps. So that means you have to show up in the systems that matter to them. For most of our customers, that ends up being Salesforce. So those are the kind of anchor components of the product. And there's also this unique thing. We started as a partner, like alliance leaders were our customers for a long time. But now this really is a multi-persona problem. It's alliance leaders, it's RevOps leaders, it's sales leaders, marketing leaders, product leaders. So there's five different personas we interact with on a regular basis. So there's like components of the product that support all those different personas.
That's quite amazing. So if we go through those pillars, I'll throw out a few names just to get a sense. So when you look on the data piece, do you overlap with someone like Crossbeam, or do you work with Crossbeam? Then when you come into co-sell, do you overlap with Workspan or PartnerTap, or do you sort of compete with them? Like how does it lay out in the overall landscape?
Yeah, it's interesting because the go-to-market landscape, I would say, exploded through the early 2020 phase. And a lot of our customers use a lot of different pieces at different times. So specifically to the one, Crossbeam we see as complementary. We have a lot of customers who use Crossbeam for kind of mapping between partners in a way that's complementary to Tackle. So I just view them as another layer in the go-to-market system stack. Workspan specifically focuses on co-sell. They do co-sell in a couple different ways, but their components with cloud co-sell do overlap with us. We think we're pretty unique in the way we unify that entire experience between data, marketplace, and co-sell. It's not, co-selling is not the outcome. Like the outcome is helping your buyer buy. So when you link, we see co-sell and marketplace as two sides of the same coin. So there's some competitive overlap there, but we also see we're kind of approaching it in a pretty unique way. PartnerTap, we also see as complementary. Their ideal customer profile is a little different than our ideal customer profile. And I think they've had good success, and we don't run into them from a competitive standpoint at all. So we're still, I don't think this problem is totally solved. I think we're still in the early days. And again, you think about, it's like the migration of infrastructure to the cloud. And you think about how long that's taken, like that's been happening. 2006 was when the first AWS service came out. So we're 19 years into cloud migration. And people would say we're maybe 30% migrated. I mean, we're probably 5% migrated of B2B software contracts to the cloud. And that is growing. Like that 100% plus number is a validated number, both from our data and the cloud providers. So that is growing fast. So, but I think there's a lot still to come.
So what about someone like Partner Stack? Like they have a marketplace. I think they also have listing services. Are they different or similar to you?
Partner Stack focuses more on demand gen. So, and again, this is where it gets really complicated. So again, we see Partner Stack as complementary. We partner with them. We have joint customers because ultimately everyone's trying to figure out their marketing system and sales system and how to layer all these additional routes to market into their marketing and sales system. So a lot of these tools fill pieces of the puzzle, but don't solve the entire universe of the problem. And yeah, I mean, I look at Salesforce, you know, a lot of people will be like, Salesforce is CRM. Salesforce is a go-to-market integration platform because all of those tools integrate into Salesforce. All of those tools meet inside of Salesforce environments, and you can blend signals of these tools together in order to create the best experience for your buyers and sellers. Like I like the idea. Sixth Sense is an interesting one from a marketing signal perspective. We see a lot of our customers use Sixth Sense to identify when people are in market for their product. And then they marry that with a high propensity to buy signal from Tackle. Like this is a high propensity to buy Microsoft customer. Put those two things together. If you have uniqueness in Microsoft, this lead should get promoted in a different way. I think you can see a lot of those tools starting to be used in complementary ways. Like,
so then coming to your customer base across these four pillars, do they need to start with the first pillar or they can start? Like, what is the buyer's journey from your customer base perspective? Where do they start and what do they do as a first step?
Yeah, we try to meet them where they are and then help them on their journey. If someone was blue ocean, had not done anything with cloud go-to-market, we would start with data to help them build a strategy, to help understand their ideal customer profile, to help them analyze their ideal customer targets, to determine their association by cloud, to build a execution plan based upon the customers they want. So, but a lot of people are not in that zone. A lot of people have done something and they've done marketplace or they've done co-sell or they've done some deals, but they haven't figured out how to get it all working together. So a lot of times we're meeting people there and then we're just trying to decompose the way they want to sell and the way their buyers want to buy and then how we could help them. So there is a fair amount of tool consolidation happening right now. There's a lot of people who built software that no longer want to maintain it or migrating to Tackle. And then the third scenario we see is scale. Like we support, you know, three of the $5 billion cloud go-to-market sellers. The problem at scale is very different than the problem at start. So again, that becomes a business process mapping. It becomes system mapping. It's a much more enterprise kind of deployment strategy. So again, like really simple, start with data, come up with your plan for focus, get selling, build the muscle. In between, it's like, how do you get the system working the way it should be working at scale? It's a different story.
So when it comes to, you know, sort of the hyperscaler, you know, you started with AWS, Microsoft, Google, et cetera. How do you overlap? Where are the commonalities and where you kind of bridge together? Can you kind of walk us through that entire customer experience and journey?
Sure. I mean, we're an extension, like I view us as an extension of the cloud platforms. And they're at the point where they're building APIs. We bring those API experiences to life for partners. So it's very complementary. That does not mean that they will not create ways to use those APIs easily. They all will, which is great. It still puts an onus on the end partner to understand those APIs and be able to take advantage of them. So there's a build scenario that still exists with the clouds. And then there's the, like, what's our joint roadmap? So we are deeply tied in with all three of the hyperscaler product teams. And we're constantly talking about the problems of the ISVs, the problems of the channel partners, the problems of the buyers. How do we align on the best way to solve those? So we have, I mean, we have pretty tight and complementary roadmaps, which I think is a big value that we bring to our customers. Because honestly, I talk to ISVs who do this themselves. And I'm like, we have a whole company that does nothing but focus on this. And it's hard. It's a lot. It's a lot of moving pieces. Everything's always changing. You have a tiny team who's trying to do this. I can't imagine how they're going to keep up. So while there is some like competition with the cloud providers, I don't view it truly as competitive. We help their partners sell more, sell faster, which is the outcome both the cloud provider and the partner want.
Got it. So coming back to sort of, let's say from a brand perspective, right, ISV, that let's say they build a cart or a catalog, right, on your platform. So the end buyer can directly come to the brand, but they can also come through the hyperscaler marketplace. How does that engagement with the end buyer comes in? Because I'm going to come to the partner side, like the go-to-market piece, but I wanted to understand how would the end buyer buy from a brand?
So this is going to get into like a little more nerdy detail of the way these marketplaces work. So in general, today, people do not go to the cloud marketplaces to initiate the buying experience. Oftentimes, when you think about how either of us would solve a problem from a B2B standpoint, we'd go to Google, we'd search it, we'd try to find some content, we'd try to find content that looks like both our company as well as the problem we're trying to solve. We'd research that, we'd get to, okay, who's someone that solves it? Then we try to figure out who's like them. And then we do some research to be like, okay, this feels like the thing. And then you get to the point where you've directionally made a decision, but then you have to figure out what's the best way to buy it. So this is the spot where like the clouds enable you to do this a couple different ways. Like the most common way is still this enterprise private offer, where you use the infrastructure of the cloud from a contract commitment standpoint in order to facilitate a custom deal through the marketplace. So you do this thing called a private offer. It'd look a lot like doing a direct deal, but would be easier and faster. Or the other option is you'd route your buyer directly to your marketplace landing page, where they could go and initiate a purchase. So that would be similar to going to your website and kicking off a purchase, but you'd be doing it on a different website, which is one of the marketplaces. But we're starting to see AWS announce something at reInvent where they're starting to decompose where you initiate a purchase and allowing you to embed purchase initiation in different places. You can embed it in your website. You could embed it into your product. You could embed it into a custom storefront that one of your channel partners had. So then you could start to control routing demand to a place that you own and then fulfilling it via the marketplace. So I said a lot there. There's like a kind of, how do you sell direct with the clouds way? That's this private offer thing. Then there's a product-led growth way where you go to a usage-based listing in the marketplace catalog. And then there's connecting to either of those via an alternative location, which is a new way. It's like new frontier of storefronts are starting to happen. So that's the most common. Everybody started with enterprise private offers, complementing with product-led growth. These storefront concepts are just starting to come online.
So maybe, John, if it's possible,
yeah,
take a customer that you have published on your website as a user story or a use case or case study. Can you kind of walk us through that journey that would just illustrate what you just said from a product wise?
Sure. Let me try to and this is where it's interesting to look at where the ISV is at in their life cycle and how they're trying to inject cloud go to market. Like Wiz is a really fascinating story. Wiz, you know, fastest company to 100 million in ARR, fastest company to 500 million in ARR. When they were building their go-to-market system, they said, we want to build a product and we want to build our go-to-market system multi-cloud, cloud go-to-market native. And they actually launched in AWS, Microsoft, and Google as they were launching the product. It's pretty sophisticated. This is not, I would say this is becoming more common today. Wiz was very much a pioneer in this. And they were able to launch, and they really had a more enterprise-focused sales motion. So they focused on that enterprise private offer motion as a way to do it, but they did it across the three hyperscalers. And then as they built their go-to-market team, they built their go-to-market team with cloud in mind. So cloud was their default route to market. And then they layered channel on top of it because security has a pretty high density of channel partners that are really successful, own buyers, own relationships. So they layered channel on top of cloud. So, and that journey became foundational to the way they built the company. And we typically think about maturity from a percentage of revenue flowing through these cloud marketplaces. Like you're in the formative days when you're in this like 0 to 5% of your revenue flowing through the cloud channels. You're starting to scale when you're in like the 5 to 10% range. You're scaling when you're going from 10 to 20. You're at scale when you're past 20. You know, companies like Wiz are far beyond that because they built the system cloud go-to-market marketplace native. CrowdStrike's a really interesting story. CrowdStrike, actually, we met CrowdStrike in 2016 when we were just three people thinking about a problem. And they're like, hey, how could we bet our, you know, cloud go-to-market on this three-person company? We love what you guys are doing. Let's stay in touch. And they went off to be an incredibly successful. Daniel Bernard, actually chief business officer at CrowdStrike today, just published. They did $1 billion last year through AWS Marketplace. This was just on LinkedIn before recording this, which is incredible. Like, 2016, we met, we talked to them, they went and built this successful business. They ended up in 2020 running into some resistance from an operations standpoint because they just didn't have the level of automation they needed to continue to grow at the pace they were growing. And that's when they came back to us. We're like, hey, where are you guys at? How is this working? And we're able to work with CrowdStrike to migrate over to Tackle, to take ownership of their go-to-market, to eliminate all of the friction that existed in their system when you think about those multiple personas, how reps use this system, how RevOps uses it, how alliances use it. And they've been a rapidly growing customer ever since. And then I love the earlier startup stories, like how, and I'm trying to think of, I mean, a lot of times the conversations with startups these days tends to be like Eclipsys as a security startup, and it tends to be helping them just figure out where they want to focus because they have so much, there's so many companies they could sell to, and how do you distill that down? And I actually think cloud becomes a really easy way to focus. Where's your product built? Who wants to use it? And how can you use the cloud to kind of go through those early stages of growth, like the 0 to 1, 1 to 10 phase? And we see you need to have product market fit. You need to have a clear definition of how your product works. But we see more and more startups saying that one of the clouds will be our first channel as we build our go-to-market systems.
So let's double click on that word channel, right? It's in the last mile. So you figured out you're on, you know, Tackle. You're distributed through maybe one or multi-cloud environment. I want to build a partner ecosystem, right? Like strategize, onboard, enable, co-market, co-sell, incentivize, accelerate the whole partner ops framework, right? So how do you play in that last mile? Do you bring a partner ecosystem to the brand? Do you have partners who are going out with your portfolio of brands? Like, talk to us about that last mile. How is it
going? Yeah. It's super interesting because, like, using a couple of those examples, like the Wiz and CrowdStrikes, as they start, they were successful with cloud, and then they're building their channel or trying to align their cloud go-to-market system with their channel. There was friction. And they, like, AWS and Microsoft and Google all have ways to connect the dots between their channels and the marketplaces now. Those are programs like CPPO, MPO. Google has a program around this that they announced late last year. But that caused new challenges for the ISV to be like, how do I actually execute on deals with this additional party in mind? And we were able to work with the cloud providers and the ISVs in order to make that experience of creating a partner offer through the marketplace with the ISV easier. So again, we kind of were laser focused on ISVs for a long time. And then we thought about how do we make the ISV's experience with their channel partners easier? That was really where we started. Now, where things are going, you know, you listen to the leaders of the partner orgs at the clouds. I'll, you know, quote Ruba Borno from AWS. And she's like, you know, we pioneered this marketplace and co-sell thing with ISVs, but we want that to be the way that we partner with all partner types. So there's a lot of focus in how do they bring the learnings from ISVs to other channel partner types, which is starting to open up this idea that there'll be more sellers. Like, how will channel partners sell on behalf of ISV through the clouds? How will they take advantage of that? And there's a bunch of complexity in there. So we see ways to use all of our primitives, like data, co-sell, marketplace, Salesforce, with that new partner type, you know, channel partner distribution system integrator, specifically. The third area that we're focused is data, and how can we use data, the data we've seen, the models we've built, in order to help channel partners figure out where to focus, similar to how ISVs distill down their ICP to focus that by cloud. How can we use our data to complement those channels? Where I think that data could help people select some partners that could be useful. But I think there is this huge world where you play, like PRM, because channel partner programs at scale are next level complicated. Like, there's so many, there's so much, there's international, there's enablement, there's all these things that have to happen to build a robust and dynamic channel partner ecosystem. I actually think like continuing to connect the dots between what's happening with cloud go-to-market and what needs to happen with partners to help these partners continue to grow is a huge opportunity.
So let's go back a little bit to that last mile. What type of partners are in this go-to-market last mile? Are they MSPs? Are they SIs? Are they individual consultants? Are they, warehouses like CDWs and others? Like, who are these people?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. I would say less so on the solopreneur, like individual style channel partners. MSP is a bigger movement. We see like the MSP marketplaces, someone like Pax8, they do a lot with the MSPs that's somewhat disconnected from the clouds, but there's some movement happening there. I think MSPs become more important to all the cloud providers. AWS announced an MSP program at reInvent last year, where the single biggest density of partners are the partners who are focused on enterprise companies, like say mid-market to enterprise companies, who have a portfolio of products that they support and a portfolio of services around those products. You could think like Optiv, Presidio, like those big partners. That's where the lion's share of partner activity has happened. And now that's rolling international, like who are those players that are happening internationally? And then that's starting to trickle down from there.
And then coming back to sort of, if you look at the overall revenue velocity through your brands, right, without getting into names, do you see sort of a constellation of, big brands that drive most of the transaction? You have a long tail, both from a brand perspective as well as channel perspective, or how is your ecosystem? What's the composition of it?
Yeah, so in the early days, there was a very strong concentration of ISVs who drove the lion's share of the dollars. You could say from like 2017 through 2021, that was the case. From 2021 to today, we've seen the success patterns get much clearer and it become much easier for ISVs to build successful businesses in combination with the clouds. So we see the participation being far greater, and we see more and more ISVs moving through that like percentages of revenue phase where, again, 4 years ago, there were a lot of people in the 0 to 5. Where now there's a lot of people in that 5 to 10, 10 to 20 phase. We're just trying to figure out how big is this? How do I connect all my programs together? How do I make this really easy from a go-to-market standpoint? So much broader success. Where there's still, I would say, a lot of trial and error is with earlier stage companies because, I mean, frankly, they're still trying to figure out how to sell their product. They're trying to figure out how to price it. They're trying to figure out how to integrate this new like route to market into an early phase. We see a bunch of variation there, and a lot of people will try and fail, or they'll try and they won't actually commit anyone to own it, which is the most common scenario. And then they fail, and then they wonder why, like, why didn't this just work? People aren't just going to show up and buy your software. That's never going to happen. And it's been like, we write the State of Cloud Go-to-Market report every year, and we've written it for the last 5 years, and it's been really fun to see the ecosystem mature. And a few of the predictions were like business applications are really coming online. We've seen, just in the last year, ServiceNow, Salesforce, Workday, like a lot of business application players take cloud go-to-market seriously. Where in the past, why would they ever need, they wouldn't need this route to market. It wasn't necessary, but now their buyers are demanding it. And I think that's the biggest thing. Buyers are changing their behavior right now. This is making sense to them. Similar to how credit card points make sense to consumer buyers. It's like, if I spend my money this way, I get a benefit. Like, I spend my money through the clouds, I get a benefit. It's obviously much more complicated than credit card points, but
So let's kind of build that. Let's kind of look forward a little bit, right? So I saw a stat somewhere. I don't want to misquote, but I do remember the number. They said roughly there's somewhere between 300 and 400,000 ISVs today. Mm-hmm. And about half of them are listed on G2. But 80% of the reviews come from about 20% of those. And majority of those 80% reviews come from the big hundreds.
Yeah.
So when you look at reviews, tells me user base concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So when you replicate that on the buying dimension, and if you kind of click forward, where do you think the marketplaces will grow? If you have to look at maybe 18, 24 month horizon, based on what you have heard from the three hyperscalers, right? Where do you think they're trying to go? And where are you trying to go with that?
I think they all want to, and it's interesting when you decompose, like, what is AWS at its core? AWS at its core is a retailer, like, and the book, The Everything Store, like, you can apply a lot of those principles to the way AWS thinks about AWS Marketplace. So AWS just in the last few months said, you can list any product on AWS Marketplace, even if it's not built here. You're not going to get the same benefits. You're not going to use our commitments. You're not going to be able to draw down. Our reps aren't going to get paid, but you can use the fulfillment infrastructure. Feel free. Like, that's that everything store concept. Like, Google takes a much more curated approach where it's like, what really aligns to Google from a infrastructure standpoint, from a core service standpoint, from a field standpoint. And they get really focused on, like, when an ISV works with Google and they can meet the criteria, they're going to be successful because Google's really committed to that. Microsoft's in between. They're still working through exactly how Marketplace fits into this. And they've invested massively over the last few years, but they all take a slightly different approach. And I do think there will be more software. It's like Moore's Law, but like more software. Like, every function is being decomposed. Every role will have an agent, will have a co-pilot, whatever it is. Every role will have multiple, because the applications those roles use will have individual co-pilots. People have to get those to work together. Like, there's this, I think, surge, and we're still in the earliest days of AI. I think all the AI infrastructure stuff is super cool. But when you actually think about knowledge workers using AI to change the way they work, to get more efficient, like, we're so in the early days of that. And there was a Sam Altman line where he's like, hey, in the future, there's going to be a single founder with 10,000 GPUs selling their software product. Like, that's a really interesting distribution problem to think about. Like, how do, if a lot of people wanted to get access to that, how would that happen? So I mean, short answer, I think there'll be more in the catalogs. I think you'll see more dollars flowing through these platforms. I think you'll see them all get creative as to how to help partners meet their buyers where they want to buy, because that's good for the platform. It's good for the partner. It's good for the buyer. And, you know, I think the growth endurance is there for many years.
So let's come to the word AI. Right. So you talked a little bit about agents, co-pilot. So when you look at your transaction mix today, do you have a sense? I saw a Battery Ventures report that in second half of 24, a bunch of enterprises ran POCs using various sort of AI tools, right? About 5.8% of them went into production, but even partial production, right?
Yep.
So POCs are one thing, but transaction-wise, what are you seeing as pure play products that are purely... Now, Synthesia may be more of a prosumer tool versus an enterprise tool, but products that are really, really focused, right, on AI versus people are blending in AI. Do you have a sense what the velocity you're seeing?
Yeah, so we have not done that analysis. It's an interesting question. I think we there's a lot of analysis work we're always doing, but it is an interesting question. We definitely see all vendors integrating AI into their product suites. And there's been some interesting research published about, are people able to command a premium for those AI add-ons, or are they just expected to be table stakes at this point? I think a lot of people are using AI to defend value from, like, the boom era of software. So you're not seeing, like, this massive premium unless you can be really clear and compelling about the value delivered for that AI add-on. All the AI companies who are getting to go to market scale are using the clouds. I will say that. And the clouds are all working really hard to figure out how to integrate the AI ecosystem around their platforms. So you'll see this probably, I mean, like if you looked at Anthropic press releases with all three cloud providers, they're all like jockeying for the next generation of AI tooling to work with their infrastructure, take part in their marketplace. So there's definitely a lot happening there. I think it's early. I mean, it's no doubt it's here to stay. Just how does it play out? I mean, I've been so focused on thinking about B2B software distribution, I haven't had as much time to think about how AI evolves, but it's going to be interesting to see.
But you kind of said it, John. So I really want to go there and see what your thoughts are, even if you have to kind of speculate a bit. So far, hyperscaler, if you look at, especially last 5 to 7 years, right, kind of driven this whole marketplace velocity, and you have been a pioneer in that space. So when you look at these 3-4 large models, right, it is obvious the models are going to get commoditized. They're already commoditized, and token prices are going to be zero, like the way data, you know, prices is zero, right? So AT&T owns the customer, they give away the bandwidth, and they're just bundling and bundling and bundling. So very likely these model companies are going to be app companies. They already have marketplaces. So what is your take on how do you see, you know, Tackle evolving into integrating with them, playing with them, what the overlaps, what are you hearing from them as per se?
I think like this decomposition of marketplaces that's happening right now, where people are breaking down marketplaces into a variety of services that do different things. The distribution of those services into multiple places will change the way technology is adopted and more so purchased in the future. And I think the intersection with AI, like AI plus platform, will continue. I think it will follow a very standard trend of cloud go-to-market where people will buy AI along with their cloud infrastructure for a period of time. So I think it actually slots into the cloud go-to-market movement that happens today. The AI ecosystem, I think, is really interesting because it's not just likely going to be one thing. Like, will there be an AI cloud or will all three clouds be AI clouds? It's probably both. Like, both will be the answer. And then if there is a new cloud, how will they cross the chasm to be able to provide the services that these other cloud providers are able to do from a marketplace, co-sell, incentives for their buyers, incentives from their sellers' perspective? That's a huge hurdle. It's a massive investment that needs to happen. But I do think ecosystems, like you think about, no product is used in isolation anymore. Like even just going back to that RevOps conversation we had about Crossbeam and Tackle and PartnerStack and PartnerTap, and like a lot of times those get used in some sort of combination. I think that's going to be true for AI. Like a lot of these things will get used together. And that leads to this point of, well, how do you buy things when you're not just buying one thing? You actually need to buy 5 things in order to get it to work the way that you want. That like also falls into that decomposition of marketplace or integration of multiple solutions into single purchases, which are pretty new frontiers. I mean, outside, the channel's been doing that forever. That's like where they made so much of their money was system integration. Like, how do I put things together to deliver value to my end customer? That needs to be digitized from an experience standpoint.
So let's talk about change, because this entire discussion has been about change, you know, evolving from like a simple idea to a complex set of solutions with 4 pillars. You're playing with the big guys, you know, you have a big vision. So talk to us a little bit about John Yankee as a leader, how the journey has kind of taught you and got you ready for the next wave of change, because AI is going to be a massive change, as you talked about, right? What is your style? I know, as you said, your team is remote. How do you work with them? How do you pull them together? How do you galvanize them to these pivot points to get them ready and excited?
Being a first-time CEO is one of the most humbling jobs, because you go from this point where most people who take this leap have had a pretty successful career. And a lot of times their successful career was in a single vector of a company. Like, I grew up in go-to-market, so I did a lot of different things in go-to-market, but I still grew up in go-to-market. I worked with product, I worked with marketing, I worked with finance and people and legal and all these other functions, but I didn't really understand how they all worked or how to lead them. Like, there's this first chasm crosser as a leader, where you have to acknowledge, like, your job is to set context and empower people who know more about what they do than you do do their best work. So I think a lot of the way I try to work is just to acknowledge who I am and what my strengths and weaknesses are and what kind of team I need around me to be successful, and then put that together into a unit that can succeed. Growing up in go-to-market, I start with customer always. Like, I spend so much of my time with customers and partners. That's where I love to be. Learning from our customers and their pain is what fuels our product roadmap and our vision. And again, like, as a leader, you just got to decide what kind of style. There's no right or wrong style. There's this, another CEO gave me a book about, it's called Outsiders, which is about non-traditional CEO profiles and how they're successful. Like, there is no single profile for a CEO. Like, they come from all different places. But again, it's your willingness, I think, to just be honest with yourself about who you are and what you do and figure out how to put a system together to thrive. So, and I think remote's really interesting. I love remote. I'm from Buffalo, New York. There's not a ton of companies here, especially when you work in tech. Like, I always traveled 85% of the time for my tech jobs, and that was painful, especially when you have a family. And when we started the company, that was the core tenant. Dylan and Brian were from Boise, Idaho, lived the exact same life. We're like, all right, there's a better way. GitLab did it. We can figure this out. But it poses challenges. How do you collaborate? How do you communicate? You have to be super proactive. You have to communicate more. So we're always trying to figure out how to run the best remote company. And we use the basics of, like, let's be the company we want to work for. And I think that's worked for us so far. So, I mean, and again, I grew up an SE, like, and to this day, that is, like, my default persona. I try to be helpful. I seek to understand. I propose solutions. I like people and engaging with people. And it's been fun to see that default persona evolve.
So I have one last question, and I can see a couple of gray hairs there. So is the John with a couple of gray hairs, if you had to go back and advise the 22-year-old, what would you say, one thing, about the journey that you led to get that person ready?
I mean, you got to be willing to try and take risks. Like, I think I wish I would have taken the risk earlier, but I grew up a lower middle class kid, and, like, stability for my family was priority number one. And at that time, I didn't feel like I was capable of taking the risk. I think, like, hindsight being 2020, I would have taken the bet on myself sooner. And then, like, be resilient. Like, I think resiliency, learning how to embrace, ask for, welcome feedback, finding people around you who are willing to give you feedback. Like, the more you figure out resiliency early in your career, the better off you'll be as you try to take on one of these journeys, because they're hard and there's no straight lines. And if you're CEO, you get asked all the questions no one wants to answer. And you just have to be willing to, like, always think glass is half full and power through. Like, so resiliency would be my other advice.
That's brilliant. So, John, we're at the top of the hour. I have way too many questions, so I have to have you back. But thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure. I learned an enormous amount, and I'm sure
thanks.
Our users and customers will learn a lot too.
Yeah, super fun chat. Thank you. We'll see you hopefully again.
Thank you.